This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
Good evening. My name is Sina Najafi. I'm the editor of Cabinet Magazine. Thank you so much for coming for tonight's event. Little screens on Lee Friedlander and Saul's new book, which has just come out from After All Books, copies of which are available there. And I know that you can probably get it from some online store, but please support the publishing industry by purchasing it if you're going to purchase it from there at the end. Saul will sign them for you. Saul is a colleague at Cabinet Magazine. He's an editor at large, writer, scholar, and critic. He's the author of the critical fiction Warhol's Dream, which came out with J.R.P. Ringier in 2007. An excerpt of it came out in Cabinet in 2001, I believe.
And ancient history.
Ancient history. And it's a fantastic fictional dialogue about between Robert Smithson and Andy Warhol as they try to go visit the Empire State Building. He's written for After All, Art Forum, Cabinet, Frieze, and other publications. He holds a PhD in French literature from Princeton University and has taught at the Pratt Institute, New York University, Princeton, and the Tyler School of Art. He recently curated a show titled Destroy, She Said, at the Boiler. It's a group exhibition exploring the relationship between art and destruction. Thanks for coming, and please welcome Saul Antal.
Thanks. Thank you, everyone. And thank you, Sina, for the really very nice invitation to do this here. I really couldn't have thought of a better place. Can everyone hear me okay? Okay, so to start, I thought what I would do, you know, the danger with a book like this is that it can, the fear, perhaps, maybe not the danger, is that it kind of devolves into a graduate seminar, which I don't want it to be. So what I thought I would do, and what I thought I would do is simply, I'm going to read a part of this. Actually, Sina, I need a favor. I realize in the back there, I need the copy of the book, which I left in the bag, of course. I'm going to read some parts of the book, but really I'm just going to talk a little bit. So I have that. And I thought about not doing that, but since the book is written, it seems almost hard not to. But what I'm going to do is to really sort of talk a little bit about how the book came to be, why I wanted to do it, and the context in which I'm hoping this book will be received. And so to start, however, I have to kind of jump between, just to show you what the book is dealing with. The series that the book is in is called the One Work Series, and it's important to know that because it really sets some fairly specific limitations about what they imagine this series is devoted to. And the editors really imagine the series being devoted to artists whose work has in some way been already received, and artists who have achieved a certain level of notoriety, but who are perhaps not at the peak of their moment, as it were, if you will. So to some extent, the series is interested in kind of riding the line between whatever is contemporary now of the moment and whatever is already art history. And the project came about because I was speaking with the editor and we were sort of batting around some names about how you guys can sit, so don't, please, there's plenty of seats. Come on in. Leslie and Sam, thanks. So the series came about when we were talking about a couple of different possibilities for the project. And if you're interested in writing about photography, as I was, some obvious names come to mind. I think I had mentioned Jeff Wall and maybe Sophie Kahl. And there were particular reasons why those were not going to work for the series. And finally, we kind of landed on Lee Friedlander And Lee Friedlander, as I was just saying to somebody here, is interesting because his body of work is, on the one hand, entirely canonical, right? He really represents the first moment in which photography is brought into the not only the museum, because that's true for the generation that precedes him, but really the discourse of art in the 1960s. And there's a very specific exhibition from 1967 called the New Documents Series, in which he, Gary Winogrand, and Diane Arbus are, this is a show that is curated by John Sarkowski at the Museum of Modern Art, and that show really represents in many ways the sort of advent or the arrival, if you will, of photography within the context of art per se. So Friedlander is really quite interesting in that he occupies this strange position. On the one hand, he's kind of an old school straight photographer who belongs to the world of photography that was very dominant in the 1950s and 60s. That goes back to figures like Walker Evans, Ad Jay. These are obviously his influences, but already anticipates the works, the work of people like Cindy Sherman, Jeff Wall, and what will become the photography that we tend to think of as contemporary art photography. So weirdly enough, in the emergence of art photography, Friedlander is in some ways overlooked. If you look at the bibliography, there's very little written on him. Aside from, there's some stuff in France, because there's a kind of sort of niche of critical art writing in France about photography. But there was one essay in 1975 by Martha Rosler, which is pretty much one of the only sort of essays that engages with Friedlander from the standpoint of art. And it's kind of an amazing essay and pretty much says it all. So when I settled on Friedlander, it was quite interesting. He's overlooked, and yet he's sort of very central, and there was very little written on him. And the other primary reason I chose this particular series that dates from the 1960s, and it has to do with television, and I have a sort of standing interest in television and its relationship to art, because one of the big questions, obviously, from that period is, what is medium and what is medium specificity? And one can ask the question, is television a medium? And the answer here is, not really, certainly not in the way that one tends to think about medium as being a sort of limiting condition that allows one to develop a critical discourse, because you can't really write about sports, let's say, in the same way you can write about sitcoms. You can't write about contemporary, whatever, serious drama a la HBO series. Take your pick, Deadwood or The Wire and so on. Television is this weird, weird thing that allows for many different, let's say, media or genres, and yet is often, I think, misunderstood as having the quality of a medium in the way that our art critics tend to think about it. So this series was really interesting to me because it represents this very strange moment in which a straight photographer who arises out of the context of straight photography in the 1950s and 60s encounters television. And what I'd like to do here is, these are PDFs. I have to kind of flip back and forth between these PDFs. The series first appears in February 1963 in Harper's Bazaar simply as a photo essay. And these are actually the pages from the magazine as photographed. So I'm showing you the actual layout. It was simply a four-page spread with the splash page on the right there, a little blurb by Walker Evans, which I'll get into, and then the second page. I'm a little technically inept, so I wasn't able to pull the PDFs into the PowerPoint, so apologies. This is the second page, just so you have a chance to see how the series looked. And then the blurb continues on that page 4, and it's 6 pictures originally. So it's these pictures of this woman that's on the cover of the book, this man in a den. That picture is called Syracuse. This photograph of the child on the television screen, and then you have this second spread. This is the February issue of Harper's Bazaar. So it appears in the context of popular culture, mass culture, fashion, etc. And it really is a moment in which you have a magazine saying, hey, everybody, there's this hot new thing out there. It's called television. Which had been around for quite a while, but had achieved really only sort of a kind of mass saturation, really in late 1950s, 1959. I have some data on that. I'm going to tell you. I'll give it to you in a minute. So that's just the series, and I'll come back to that. Let me just jump into this here. So the little screens first appears in 1963. However, in 2001, Lee Friedlander's gallery in San Francisco, the Frankel Gallery, David Frankel Gallery, publishes a volume called The Little Screens, which gathers a series of 33 pictures from the 1960s, dating between 1961 and 1969, that then replaces, as it were, within our consciousness, what the little screens are. So between 1963 and 2001, The Little Screens was just a series that had existed in the magazine. He had shown them individually over the course of the 60s and 70s in various exhibitions, so you might see this little screen or that little screen, but not in any systematic kind of way. So this was a sort of series that he continued to pursue throughout the 60s, and that really ended in 1969. We don't have anything after that. I don't know if he actually made anything after that, but the book only frames it as a series that dates between 61 and 69. So these things will become hopefully significant. So one of the things that was facing me was to really deal with this series and understand what happened in 63, first of all, and what had happened, what had brought Lee to gather them, and in what way in 2001. And what's really quite clear is that there's a sort of rethinking, reworking, and a sort of expansion of the original photo essay. And that's what I'm going to be spending some time talking about. But I like to sort of just start by showing you, there are not too many texts, only a couple of texts, and we'll get the pictures very quickly. I just wanted to share with you, this is the final paragraph of Martha Rosler's essay in Art Form in 1975. Looking at his photos, we are in the same situation as Little Red Riding Hood when she saw dear old grandma but noticed some wolf-like features and became confused. Our pleasant little visit has some suggestion of a more significant encounter, but we don't have enough information to check. The level of import of Friedlander's work is open to question and can be read anywhere from photo funnies to metaphysical dismay. And so Rosler, I mean, the essay is nothing but brilliant in its observations and its putting together an account of Lee Friedlander's work up until that time. The essay was actually a review that appeared of an exhibition that year in New York, I believe. But what I'll just sort of hang my hat on here a little bit is this kind of weird ending and where she says, it's not clear what the import of Friedlander's work is. And that sort of lack of clarity, where he falls in the development of contemporary art, was there from the beginning. And it seems like it has pursued us or has continued, because in a way there really is no clear account of what his work is all about in contemporary art. And she really puts her finger on it right from the beginning. And what's really clear is that that's quite systematic. It's not just an oversight. It's not because people don't know how to add it all up, but rather because there's a sort of fundamental ambiguity or ambivalence, if you will. And these are negative terms that I don't mean to be negative in the work. And what I try to do in the book really is to begin just trying to read that and understand what where that's coming from in the pictures. And then to sort of contextualize that within the development of art. Okay, so this is a second blur. This is a second quote, but this is it's an edited and shortened version of Walker Evans' blurb in the original 1963 essay. I'll just lay these things out, and then we can. Then when I read, hopefully they'll make some more sense. The pictures on these pages are, in effect, deft, witty, spanking poems of hate. It just so happens that the wan, reflected light from home television boxes casts an unearthly pall over the quotidian objects and accoutrements, which is spelled accoutrements, we all live with. This electronic pallor etiolates our bedboards and pincushions, our mute scratch pads, and our inglorious pillboxes. It is a half-light we never notice, as though we were dumbstruck by those very luminous screens we profess to disdain. This disdain is not much mitigated by Friedlander's selective pot shots. What are those faces that moon out from the screen, taken out of context as they are here? That baby might be selling skin rash, the careful, good-looking woman might be categorically unselling marriage, and the home and total daintiness. Here, then, from an expert hand, is a pictorial account of what TV screen light does to rooms and to the things in them. And there's a little bit more, but it's not as important as what I sort of selected out here. And this is very typical of Walker Evans. If you ever read Walker Evans, it's very high-handed. But what he really seems to grasp right off from the beginning is that it's not really clear in these pictures whether these are pictures of the rooms or of the TV screens. And that ambiguity is actually fundamental to the book. The space of the room and how it's transformed and how it's maybe evacuated as a spatial condition is much of what happens in the book, which I explore. So, okay, having laid that out, I can now show you maybe better pictures. So this is the splash page picture. And this is the cover picture called Philadelphia. And I'll be moving back and forth, I think, through these. This is the picture opposite the splash page, underneath the picture of the previous one. So this one is top left, bottom left of the splash page. And then on the second page, there's this one and this one and another one, which I'm just not able to get a digital copy of. Okay, so just to lay those out, I'm just going to read a little bit from the beginning, and we'll take it from there. In February 1963, Harper's Bazaar published a four-page picture essay by Lee Friedlander titled The Little Screens, accompanied by a short text by Walker Evans. It comprises six black-and-white photographs of televisions that look, within the relatively small format of the magazine, like glowing postage stamps illuminating empty rooms. In each picture, a 1960s-era television set made by companies today long gone, such as Andrea, Belmont, Crosley, Electromatic. These are just too good, so I like to list. Farnsworth, Cuba, National, Philco, Sightmaster, and Viewtone. That's my favorite. Fills the space it occupies with cathode ray light. The splash page image is of a sparsely furnished bedroom in what looks to be a modest middle-class American home. The viewer looks past the expanse of a neatly made bed and the curved wooden footboard. So I can just jump back. Where are you guys? Here. To a small television sitting on a table against the wall. What immediately captures our attention in this image is the intensity of the face of a young child looking out at us from the television screen. If you have children, you can probably grasp Friedlander's wry take on parenting. You're likely familiar with a difficult moment in which your child arrives at the foot of your bed in the early hours and looks semi-consciously up at you with the expectation that you may make room or fetch a glass of water or find a favorite stuffed animal. Friedlander's family narrative is extended by the two pictures that appear opposite the splash page. The photograph on top presents a simple living room furnished with a pair of armchairs and a standing lamp. Next to the lamp is a boxy television showing the face of an attractive woman. She returns our gaze, yet seems somehow out of place, isolated in the well-appointed room. On the television screen in the picture directly below, we see a man. He seems to be in a den, complete with small desk lamp, ashtray, and book. These objects sit on top of the TV, which is placed before a window. The story that Friedlander composes with these first three photographs is well known. The man, woman, child, holy trinity of the nuclear family served as a foundation of post-war American life and became the bread and butter of television programming. Father Knows Best, Leave It to Beaver, The Brady Bunch, and a long list of other shows would depict not only an ideal of domestic bliss, they would also serve as powerful tools in the pursuit of establishing that ideal. On the following pages, Friedlander complicates the fantasy of domesticity. Next, we see a woman's downward gaze captured on a small television sitting on a dresser. The group ends with a man's face on a television embedded in the furniture of a motel room. Perhaps these figures are the other woman or man, suggesting that the television screen is a medium of illicit desire. Ordered in between this pair is a photograph of an empty leather lounge chair. That's the one I don't have, although I do have a version of it that reappears later in 2001. Flanked by an ashtray on one side and a television on the other. On TV, a woman in a leotard is exercising, and clearly she's an object of desire, both ours and that of the absent occupant of the chair. Of course, the family has been a crucial domain of not only television, but also photography, since at least the introduction of Leica rangefinder cameras in the 1920s. Later in the 1960s, Kodak Instamatic cameras made photographic technology even more widely available to the masses. In the mid-60s, the French sociologist Pierre Bourdieu noted that the family photograph is a ritual of the domestic cult in which the family is both subject and object, because it expresses the celebratory sense which the family gives to itself and which it reinforces by giving it expression. It's kind of a great book, actually, called L'Art Moyen, which is the middle class art, as it were, and it's an exploration of class with Bourdieu, as is always the case. Cameras go with family life, Susan Sontag remarks in On Photography. Through photographs, each family constructs a portrait chronicle of itself, a portable kit of images that bears witness to its connectedness. Domesticity, one can argue, is not merely a privileged situation for photography. It is paradigmatic of the social role of photography and photographic memory in the visual economy of modern life. When large numbers of televisions began to be taken into the U.S. home in the 1950s, it complicated this economy. Its presence combined the role of photography with that of radio, gathering the family in a compelling new mode of communion, home entertainment. Programming broadened in the decades that followed, simultaneously sustaining and undermining traditional models of the family and its place in society. Cable television spawned alternatives no longer limited by the family values that had dominated network television. In New York, Robin Bird's infamous stripper extravaganza was first broadcast in 1977, and Andy Warhol's 15 Minutes began airing on MTV in 1985. So I don't know if you grew up in New York, but that was like sort of a rite of passage in the 80s, if you were a kid. In the new century, popular dramas such as The Sopranos and The Wire gained acclaim for breaking away from quote-unquote family-friendly television for telling grittier, far less idealized stories about American life. Okay, so today we know that, in fact, television, this is now a truism in the last few years, that television is the medium of serious, dramatic, attention to social and political questions, historical issues, and so on. In one sense, the little screens represents a post-war redux of the now classic Depression-era photographs of Southern sharecroppers taken by Walker Evans and published alongside a text by James A. I always mispronounce this. A.G. I always want to say A.G., and I don't know why. In the book, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, the television, that bright and glowing electronic hearth put forth by its producers as the new agora of the American middle-class commons, replaces the fireplaces of the impoverished family homes that Evans' images detailed. I didn't bring in any of those pictures, but I have a feeling most of you know what those are like. Throughout the 1960s, Friedlander continued to photograph television sets as solidified centerpieces of the American modern interior. Identified and named only by the cities in which they were taken, these photographs are the indoor analogs of his lifelong engagement with the American landscape, embodied in books such as The American Monument and, more recently, America by Carr. In the latter, in photographs such as Montana, Friedlander uses, did I bring that one in? Okay, so this is a sort of ordering question. I have some of these pictures here. Okay. Friedlander uses the windshields and side or rear view mirrors of cars as indirect framing devices. In effect, like his pictures of televisions, they are images of little screens. In the brief copy that accompanied the little screens in Harper's Bazaar, Evans presents Friedlander as unabashedly hostile to the newfangled apparatus. The pictures on these pages are, in effect, deft, witty, spanking little poems of hate. He goes on to say that the wan reflected light of home television boxes casts an unearthly pall over the quotidian and objects and accoutrements. We saw that citation, underscoring the clinical and detached quality of the images. While this is certainly the case, the photographs themselves suggest that Friedlander's conception of television did not end there, that in fact his photographs represent an evolving, playful, and serious contemplation of the new technology. In flipping through the book, and now I'm talking about the 2001 book, which I don't have a copy of here, but I can, I'll go back to these. Boy, it really is at the end. Sorry. That's the book, or a copy of it. That's the book. I have two pictures of it. Anyway, that's the book. What's kind of cool about the book, if you know it, is that the screen in the middle is actually kind of a hologram, and you know, if you move it, you get two different images. So it changes the image just like on a television screen, which might seem kind of dumb, but it's actually very important for the purposes of this talk, as hopefully make clear. In flipping through the book, the viewer grasps that Friedlander's pointed story about American domesticity evolves into a nuanced encounter with television that is as much conversation as agon, as much reflection as combat. This is the story of the uncanny double of photography, a masked impersonator that is as seductive and amusing as it is sinister and dangerous. In other words, the little screens do something quite remarkable. They consider and treat a classic photographic theme, the family, the home and domesticity, but they link it to a reflection on the implications of the emergence of television for photography and on the relation between the two media. What do we make of Friedlander's encounter with television? What can these pictures tell us about the relationship between television and photography? And what does this relationship represent within the broader context of the critical aesthetics of modernism at the moment of its exhaustion, the emergence of pop and mass culture as crucial points of reference, and the gauntlet thrown down by minimalism and a slew of post-minimalist practices that extends into our own day and age? That's the gauntlet, not the practices. So it's extends, which is a typo in the book, which is why I'm pointing that out. What might it have meant in 1963, and what is its interest today when broadcasting, like nearly everything else, has migrated to digital platforms viewed on laptops, smartphones, tablets, and so on, that is, on so many little screens? So, okay, so that's a little bit the beginning, and really I'm just trying to sort of give you a little bit the framework of what I'm trying to think a little bit about, because television seems to be a little screen, and the genealogy of it extends all the way into our own day, obviously when little screens are ever smaller and are something that we carry with us on our person and that we live with in such an intimate way. Let me jump back a little bit here. What I wanted to do now is explain a little bit the context in which I thought about these pictures. Am I in the right? Yes. I see two things here. Just to give you a little bit of a frame, one of the things I try to do is really look at 1963 as a sort of crucial moment. And it seems like a couple of things are happening. One is obviously the emergence of pop and the emergence of television within the context of art. This is a 1960 painting where Warhol hasn't yet developed the screen printing method, but television is really important for him already. And in the oval, what you see is the price of the television that he's sort of rubbed out a la Rauschenberg. He's still very much interested and sort of following Rauschenberg at this moment. And by 1963, obviously, he's making his movies. They're a very important moment because they really mark a sort of departure from painting that not only he is involved with, but many, many other artists. The more important reference here is Nam June Paik's exposition of music, electronic television, which opens in the same year in Germany. This is quite important because Paik explicitly wants to think about television as a medium for art making. And he's one of the first to do so, obviously influenced by Dada and Fluxus. And what he wants to do is to essentially complicate what he considers the sort of one directionality of mass media at that time. He wants to turn it into a two-way medium rather than a one-way medium. And here is a sort of book cover showing you another picture of what that really amounts to. If you want to think about intervening within the television from the standpoint of the apparatus. What's interesting is that he is not the first to do so. This was already a project that Bertolt Brecht had imagined in the 1920s with radio. And in fact, in 1929, he staged this radio symphony called The Lindbergh Flight, written by Kurt Weill and Paul Hindemith. And what was interesting about this, I think you can read it. I'll just read it, just because otherwise we'll be out of sync. The Lindbergh Flight, written for the Baden-Baden Chamber Music Festival in 1929. The world premiere on July 27th was a purely radiophonic event. The piece was transmitted into several surrounding rooms from a space converted into a broadcasting studio. For the concert performance on the following day, Brecht divided the stage into two halves, the ensemble, chorus, and speakers on the left, and on the right, separated by a screen, I don't know what to make of that, the screen in the middle, sat Joseph Witt representing the listener and to declaim the sung part. In the radiophonic version, in other words, when you listen to this on the radio, this role was supposed to be realized by each listener at home. In other words, you were going to sing along with it. And in fact, in Germany, there was a program in the 1960s where they would play music leaving out a particular instrument or piece. And you could, if you were a cellist, for example, you could play along with it and you would be playing in a chamber piece suddenly with three or four other people. So this idea actually had some legs in the history of radio in Germany. So you have on the one hand, you have somebody like Warhol thinking about television as the sort of promulgator of mass media imagery, right? You have the emergence of what is nowadays called critical television art, which really tries to engage at the level of the apparatus. So Paik will take magnets and try to modify the wavelengths so that it works with the actual technology, you know, inside the machine, as it were. And that obviously leads to a whole genealogy of contemporary art that goes through figures like Bruce Nauman, Dan Graham. There are many, many other names I can list there. You also have, however, the emergence in the 1960s and 70s of another context, which is the context of the idea of art photography and the idea of the picture as a condition for aesthetic experience. And the sort of great champion of that is Michael Fried. And this is from his recent book, Why Photography Matters as Art as Never Before. So I'm really just laying out sort of three different ways this moment gets picked up and sort of argued in the aftermath of it. Starting in the 1970s and 80s, art photographs began to be made not only at large scale, but also, as the French critic Jean-François Chevrier was the first to point out, for the wall. This is widely known, and no one will contest it. Such photography immediately inherited the entire problematic of beholding in the terms defined in my previous writing, because Michael Fried always speaks about his own writing, of theatricality and anti-theatricality that had been central first to the evolution of painting in France from the middle of the 18th century until the advent of Edouard Manet and his generation around 1860, and second to the opposition between high modernism and minimalism in the mid and late 1960s. So 1963 seems to represent this very sort of tense moment where you have a kind of fracturing of the, if you will, the modernist unity of art into a number of different directions. Let me spend a little time talking about the history of television. So television actually dates back to the 19th century, where they had electromechanical forms of it, which are inconceivable to us because they're not broadcast. The first broadcasts date to the 1920s. They happen in London, in Russia. It's one of those things that is sort of invented at the same time in many different places in slightly various forms, like photography. But it was not until after World War II that television succeeded in becoming a mass consumer product and industry, and it wasn't until the 1950s that it received broad public acceptance. Between 1942 and 1949 in the United States, there are 3.6 million units sold, but in 1959 alone, that number goes to 68 million units. So you can see that, in fact, television has a very, very slow buildup, but 1959 is this moment where suddenly everybody has a TV in the house. So that's only a few years before the series gets going. 1959, I believe, is also the first year of, let's say, the Alfred Hitchcock series on television. So television really kind of hits in 1958, 1959. One consequence of this was that TV soon challenged the dominance of the picture magazines. For example, Look and Life in the U.S., Paris Match and View in France, that had served as the primary mass cultural bases of 20th century photography since the Leica revolution of the 1920s. And they would go into a long decline. The Look and Life would go out of business in the 1970s. And the others would transition essentially to various forms of celebrity picture magazine in order to survive. So there's this kind of moment in which photography enters the museum. Television enters the sort of scene of photography and begins to displace it within the context of mass culture. And Lee Friedlander starts making these pictures. The other context for this that is sort of interesting is the emergence of photoconceptualism with somebody like Ed Ruscha. And I'll just show you a few pictures of his famous every building on the Sunset Strip, which he makes over a course of a number of years, pretty much the same time that Lee Friedlander is doing the little screens. This is a book project, as you may know. It is also a photo project, and it unfolds so that you can see the Sunset Strip going in two directions. It also folds. It is an object in that regard, and it can be folded in a number of ways. For Jeff Wall, if you know anything about Jeff Wall's writings, this represents the last moment of avant-garde practice. It's the sort of farthest that you can go in the negation of the various values of art, the emergence of amateurism, of low-quality image-making, of non-interesting, unformatted practices, all of these things that Clara Bishop, for example, calls de-skilling. And Wall argues in a couple of different essays, he essentially argues that after this critique of the sort of history of the Western picture, which begins with Manet for him, what you end up with is the picture. Because photography is unable to do away with the picture entirely, this is as far as you get. So this represents the farthest possibility for a certain kind of modern idea of art, and it plays out in a certain kind of photoconceptualism that foregrounds amateurism. The other artists involved are people like Dan Graham, Robert Smithson, Hubler, and many, many others. What's quite interesting is that Lee Friedlander doesn't really seem to be summarizable in any of these particular models of accounting for this moment. what is pretty clear is that he's not interested in doing what Nam June Paik does. He's not interested in sort of the technical conditions of photography, of television, and he doesn't really embrace, it seems, what Jeff Wall does, which is to take photography from something that you look at primarily in your home through magazines or in books, which is the way it is received in the 50s and 60s, and goes on the wall as large scale pictures or tableaus a la 19th century or 18th century or European classical painting, which is the direction that Jeff Wall follows. So the question is, what happens in these images then that really seems to sort of develop a different line of development? That's kind of what interested me. So I'll read another short passage, and then we can pause and talk. And what I'm going to try to do now is sort of characterize the pictures in some way and talk about what happens in the pictures and how they might operate within this context. One might begin to consider the intersection of art and media and Friedlander's pictures by noting that they anticipated the counterintuitive quality of television that Richard Serra identified in his early video piece. Produced in collaboration with Carlotta Faye Schulman, television delivers people. Recalling, by the way, I do have that here, and I wasn't sure whether I would show it. But if you want to see it, I'm very happy to show it. It is right. I have it queued up. There it is. Television delivers people. Let me read it a little bit. Recalling and turning on its head Bertolt Brecht's... Sorry. What was that? Cord. Recalling and turning on its head Bertolt Brecht's 1930s vision of two-way radio as the progressive answer to a corporate capitalist media, Serra used the format of a 1970s public service announcement, text scrolling down the screen, in order to propose the idea that television does not merely bring programming and information into our homes through a one-way transmission, it also transmits its audience. Individuals are televised and thus delivered to advertisers, the state and mass media corporations. Serra's insight indirectly concerns the important issues of privacy and surveillance that have emerged in the 21st century, with the rise of the internet and social media. Social spaces permeated and commodified by our little screens, which increasingly set the norms of daily life. Both the common space of the home or domicile or the wider space of the landscape, what phenomenologists and other theorists call the habitus or the life world, or more simply the world, have been transformed into a paradoxically public model of privacy. In our present-day sharing economy, we have grown accustomed to broadcasting the most banal and mundane moments and elements of our lives and commenting on those of our friends, quote unquote, in a public manner. In our mediatized world, every reality is haunted by the presence of those who are not, in any simple sense, present, but whom we carry with us wherever we go. Do you guys want to see this? I know you probably, some of you maybe have seen this. Yeah. It's very short. Let me full screen it. I hope there's no ad, because it's YouTube. So if there is, it's really...
there to get into TV. It seemed like a good way to get his attention.
Is there a... Oh, we didn't plug in the audio? Okay. pause it because, you know, life was slower in the 70s. We don't have time to watch the whole thing. But you get the point. And, you know, I don't want to belabor it. And I think it's sort of, at this point, well known, whereas in the 70s that idea was not so well known. But it's just as another sort of context for what is going on here. Now, what's interesting is that Friedlander doesn't go down this road. He doesn't go down the road of the critique of television in the same way that Pike, Sarah, and others do. So the question is, what in the world does he do then? Find where I am. This transformation is often understood in starkly Platonic terms, that is, the transformation of the world into something commodified. That is, as an emptying out and evacuation of the depth and thickness of reality, and a substitution in its place of a superficial existence, something unreal or artificial and thus suspect. However, such a dichotomy fails to capture the more profound relation between surface and depth, presence and transmission that is activated and goes live with the advent of the television screen. And, you know, I don't pretend to fully account for this whole thing. It's a big project, but I'm hoping that this book actually begins to look at this problem in a little more intense way than has been up until now. In the late 1950s, Friedlander shot a number of portraits of jazz musicians in New York that evolved into a series eventually published in 1993 as the Jazz People. In images such as the 1960 color photograph of John Coltrane above, or a 1969 portrait of Miles Davis, Friedlander styles jazz musicians in the romantic image of the great artist, and by extension, as the ideal of modern individualism, elsewhere embodied in art by figures like Jackson Pollock or Picasso. These images, many of which were shot as professional commissions, present the heroic myth of the artist, through a combination of color, mood, and tone, starkly absent in the 1963 picture essay, The Little Screens. The difference between the Kodachrome color photograph portraits and the black and white surfaces that Friedlander first presented in Harper's Bazaar is more than merely stylistic. The choice of black and white photography becomes a permanent feature of his images, even when the human figure returns. Friedlander, in this way, has turned away from certain ideals of interiority embodied by the look, by the classic magazine portrait image, the editorial portrait, as it were, and the return of the gaze that it implies. And this is perhaps, you know, emblematic of that. When you look at a magazine editorial portrait, the most important thing is that the person is looking back at you and makes that connection with you, and you make that connection with that person. Obviously, this is played with, and this is not some sort of unbreakable rule. People break it all the time, but it is in many ways a sort of baseline from which magazine portrait photography functions and continues to function even today. The substitution, however, of the screen or the mask for the face shifts the center of gravity, for example, in this image of R.B. Kitai, the author, away from the ideal point behind his face, his self, and onto the surface, canceling the ideal distance implied by the traditional portrait. Just as Friedlander presents television in the intimacy of the decor and geometry of the home, he sets Kitai's features and closed eyes against the background of images and asserts the failure of the image to return our gaze. He replaces the here and now of the erratic work with the here and now of the point of reception and invites the viewer to look at the surfaces of the face and of the visible. The result is a viewing subject who is cast, so to speak, out of itself onto the plane of visibility, a looking subject somehow in exile from itself. So this is the graduate seminar moment, and it's one citation that I'll provide for you that is kind of the theoretical source of what I'm doing, and I'm just going to allude to it a little bit here. According to the French philosopher Jean-Luc Nancy, such a looking outside of oneself or in exile from oneself doesn't so much occupy a position as is forced out of one because the look is, for him, this opening onto the world. And this is a quote, the look is the thing that goes out. So the French qui sort, the thing of the exit, and I'm being very literal here, la chose de la sortie. And to be more precise, the look is nothing phenomenal. On the contrary, it is the thing in itself of exiting from oneself, only through which one makes oneself a subject. And the thing in itself of exiting is not a gaze upon an object, but an opening onto the world. Okay, so this was a little out of place. Let me jump back here, and I'll show some little screens. Nancy's conception of the subject outside and alongside itself in the experience of looking, and of senses more broadly, offers an intriguing way in which to understand a televisual condition that concerns Friedlander. In the 2001 volume, The Little Screens, it is quickly apparent just how out of place the televisions are in the spaces they occupy. So here's the cover. This is the first picture, and hopefully the idea that this series becomes about looking, and the look becomes immediately apparent in this image. But almost as if manufacturers didn't yet understand what it was they were making, and in spite of the extraordinary lengths they went to in designing and sizing models for every possible place in the house, these televisions simply do not fit. Rather, they seem, in Friedlander's treatment, to be doubles of the very aliens or monsters being broadcast into American homes at that time. Take, for example, the photograph titled Florida that shows us a television on a low corner table alongside a radiator, and that is this one. Whereas the latter is shaped for the space that it occupies alongside the wall, the television has rabbit ear antennas sticking out of it and a power cord that leads awkwardly across the front of the picture to the wall alongside the radiator. Its incongruity is heightened by the fact that there's an image on it that makes no sense in the real space. A policeman on a motorcycle seen frontally as if he were coming at us. Of course, we've long been inured to the real, to the unreal and surreal quality of this juxtaposition, but Friedlander's frontal presentation of the policeman casts the failed synthesis of image space and real space into sharp relief. In one of the photographs in the Harper Bazaar picture essay, later titled Philadelphia, and that is, that is the picture of the woman on the cover, so if I can do this very quickly, I apologize. I hope that's not disorienting. The exchange of attributes between the woman on television and the surrounding living room operates far more indirectly, much as advertising establishes associations between products and figures through juxtaposition. The woman's classic beauty extends her allure to the handsomely furnished room, and the same is true in reverse. Both seem austere and appealing. Unlike the faces of movie stars on the quote-unquote big screen, who seem more alive and more real to us than ourselves by virtue of their scale, the little screen reduces the subject to something less than alive, something merely lifelike. But this quote-unquote imitation of life, incidentally the name of a 1959 film starring Lana Turner as a well-coiffed or coiffed housewife, brings into relief the movement of anthropomorphism that operates within this image. What Friedlander thus achieves is the opposite of the domestic intimacy and homey reassurance that television promises. There's a powerful sense of apprehension in the little screens. The TVs are always on, and their screens present a world that is somehow out of place. So, As I sort of look at the pictures, and here I'll just talk a little more loosely, I really try to explore this out-of-placeness that is thematized in these pictures. And you can see it happening in many different ways. So this picture in the second page of the original 63 series has this picture of this woman. The question that sort of arises is, well, you know, who is the person A who is there? Why is she not there? And why do we have this kind of feeling that, in fact, she should be in the room? Obviously, the mirror behind her and the sort of emptiness that it suggests is sort of a further development of that. Similarly here, the sort of great play here is obviously between him being there on the television and nobody being there in the in the bed. And what the book really tries to do is sort of trace that dynamic, this kind of doubleness or this absence, this sort of indirectness of the image. There are no people in these images, through a series of questions around the dynamic between apparatus and picture that I talked about, between sort of Jeff Wall's idea of the picture and, let's say, a Bruce Nauman-esque idea of the apparatus, and through another through a series of terms that have been used to understand the place of photography in contemporary art. The one that's sort of most interesting in some ways for me is the notion of this archival impulse that Hal Foster develops back already now in 2001, which happens to be the same year that this book comes out. One of the things that's sort of interesting about that idea is that the archival impulse for him speaks in the same way that photographs do. It is something that can happen in a context where there is no particular artistic desire happening. It is a random picture sometimes. It is a picture of nothing particularly interesting. So it really comes out of the kind of thing that Ed Ruscha develops in that photo. Conceptualism really develops in the 1960s, and artists like Robert Smithson do, but doesn't propose an aesthetic ideal. It certainly doesn't propose an ideal of beauty, and it doesn't propose also, and this is where Hal Foster's term is a little bit controversial, I think, is it doesn't propose any kind of social ideal or political ideal for art. What it merely allows for is this idea that the image connects two places, but it connects them in a way that doesn't bring them together in a kind of active matrix. And what is really compelling to me about these pictures and about pictures that Friedlander makes in other contexts is this kind of ambivalence that Martha Rosler originally already saw in 1975 that has to do with the way he flattens pictures. That has to do with the way juxtapositions take place, even when they're not pictures of screens. The notion of screen seems to be a kind of compositional idea that he works with, where he forces us to consider images one after another within some relationship to one another. But that relationship is not predefined. He doesn't tell you what you can understand, what political idea you're going to take away from it, what aesthetic idea you might take away from it, but forces you, if you're going to actually look at the picture, to engage with the picture in that sense as an archive. So in this image, which has somebody in it, you have to really make your way around it piece by piece. There is no single picture. What they are individual segments or parts that you have to put together. Here's another picture from the 19... This is a picture that he took in Newark, New Jersey. And the screen idea is already present here. And what you need to do is try to put together the relationship between the big man and the young boy, the waiter, I suppose, or maybe the owner of the restaurant, and what's across the street, what's there in the advertising in the corner. And you have a similar kind of dynamic happening in the little screens. Here, the joke is that you have a kind of quasi-pornographic moment. You have somebody sitting in a room looking at this television shot, this blonde, and of course her body is now substituted with this dresser. And the question of that substitution is how you are forced to make your way through these pictures. In this image, that's Lyndon Johnson on the television. You're forced to try to understand the relationship between what's going on television and, let's say, what's happening in those little pictures on the counter. Chances are those kids are actually grown up, and one of them may actually be now fighting in the Vietnam War that is revving up at precisely this moment, 1963. Here again, you have a picture of a woman crying and the person whose shirt that is, who is not present. So the archival impulse is this sort of demand that the photo imposes on you to make connections and reconstruct these images in ways that don't really follow either Jeff Wall's idea of the picture, nor Nam June Paik's idea of the apparatus, nor, for that matter, really the kind of photo conceptualism that Ed Ruscha begins to unfold. But the closest one, I think, there is Ruscha, and it's in that genealogy that you have to understand it. The book sort of continues on here, but I think I'm definitely out of time, and I've imposed on your time quite a lot. Thank you very much, all of you, for coming. And if you want to find out what happens, you can read the book. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Saul. I don't know if there are any questions. We have time for one or two questions, if there are any.
David.
I was wondering when you made the Johnson photo, and there's a couple of other ones in that book that always kind of stuck out for me. It's like weird because it is a recognizable thing.
Yeah.
And they never quite seem to function the same way. And I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Yeah, that's the only one in that. What's the other one you're thinking of? I don't think there's another one.
I got confused.
Yeah, that's the only one.
Okay, so
in that one. Yeah, it's interesting. I hadn't thought about it. I don't know. I mean, if there had been two or three, it would be more compelling to try to sort of put something together. But if it's just one, you know, it might be that the... But this is the picture, a version, by the way, of the one that was absent that I didn't manage to show you guys. So there's two versions of this. There's one where the woman is sort of holding another position. This is the one that's on the second page of the spread in 63. I don't know. I don't know that it's hard to make a case for it being important because there's only one of them. If it were systematic, as he tends to be, where, let's say, you have Johnson and Kennedy and others present, then I would want to do something with it, but I don't know. Do you have a thought about it?
No, I don't. So I think I just wonder if it doesn't throw the behavior of the rest in its kind of relief, because it does seem more sociological or critical or more critical of media. It feels more critical of media when it's actually a famous person, and that sort of flatness and ambivalence.
Yeah. And I mean, what's interesting is maybe the other people that are on the screens, and there are a number of recognizable people, if we were there in 1960, we might recognize them, but we don't. There's one that's so the picture of the eye, for example, is a close-up, and then later in the book, he brings in the shot. I don't have a copy of it. I can't show it to you. You can see whose head that is. It's a television announcer. I don't know who it is. I've never seen it before. And I actually did sort of take a moment to try to find one day, I remember, if I could actually sort of somehow, but then it was just such a crazy, impossible idea. I didn't pursue that line of investigation. But it's a great question.
Is the Johnson one the only one with other photos in it? Because that's another thing with it. It has the photos of the children above it. So it's also so much more busy in that way than the other ones.
I'm thinking now, I think so. There's one that has, there are different objects in many of them. The one of the man has the book on top of it, and there's, you can sort of read the cover of the book, but there's no picture on it, so I think so.
Maybe just picking up on that, and now this image makes me want to ask this question all the more. Maybe not just a question about history and historical context, but also about temporality and liveness or deadness, maybe for that matter, or the uncanny quality of the photograph, potentially uncanny quality of the photograph. What strikes me so much, I was really fascinated by the question of scale, little screens or big screen or frames within frames and so forth. But also the question of like flow, televisual flow, and liveness of a televisual image. but how much those particular images that you showed seem so much more like portraits that are not even freeze frame looking images, but look like they themselves are photographs being photographed, when instead we see them on television, so we're assuming they weren't, and they were just snapshot. They just happened to be captured in the moment in a streaming flow of different images. But maybe something about, if you could say a little something.
The note I was trying to end on, which is actually a sort of an extended development in the book, but I don't really have time to talk about it. This idea that one of the things he does, right, one of the things that these pictures do is they force you to move. You have to essentially break the picture up into multiple pictures and then move between them. You establish a flow within the picture. So one of the lines of argument here is that the way they function is like television, because you have to flow in them temporally. You can't read them as image. That's why they're not pictures in the way that Jeff Wall or Michael Fried imagines them. For them, the condition of the photograph is that you take it all in all at once. You see the whole thing all at once, and they're unified. But these are impossible to look at in that way. You have to actually watch them as if you were watching television. That's why that image in the front of the book is kind of interesting, that sort of the holograph that he puts in, that cheap little nice thing, which is wonderful. It really announces that as a kind of keynote of how these pictures operate. You need to watch them. You don't look at them. So the look that goes out is a kind of watching in the way that you watch television. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's exactly what, to my mind, is the sort of archival quality to become these kind of archives where you draw relationships, but these relationships are tenuous and they're personal. They need to be reconstructed after the fact. And so the picture, in a way, never really exists as a fixed entity. And that's, in a way, what I think they emblematize. And they're obviously allegories of this, right, in some ways. They're not literally doing this. But if you want to take them seriously on their own terms, that's kind of where you're forced to go as a mode of looking.
I have a question about the titles, actually. Who gave them the titles? Friedlander did?
Yeah, Friedlander gives them the titles, and he tends to do this with pretty much everything. It's just a place location. So it's not... It's very unclear whether they're titles in the way, let's say, a Jeff Wall picture is a title. So just to create the contrast, he'll just locate them so where the picture was taken, and they won't be at all...
Right, but when you're outside in a particular location like that, you can sort of see, okay, that's X or Y, or if you know the place well, you would locate it. But a very banal room with a radiator on the side saying this is in this place almost seems like the disjunction between the specific locality and the totally illegible interior seems almost like a strange... And I just wonder if somebody else had given them those titles, or he himself decided that...
No, they're titled like that in the book.
This is Baltimore,
That's how they're titled in the magazine, and that's how they're titled in the book, and that's how all of his other pictures are titled.
Right.
There's never a picture that has any other title in any series that Lee Friedlander's ever done. Except for the portraits of the... Because those are professional commissions, and they're not... But actually, when you look at the full series of the Jazz People... a lot of them are group pictures, and if it's not one of those commissioned portraits that I just showed, it's the location as well. Mm-hmm. So it's John Coltrane and five other people in a bar or whatever in New Orleans or
New York. It almost seemed to function to make the TV non-localized,
Yes.
It could be any room, almost anywhere.
So, yeah. And that's
is there
the.
One more question? We have time for one more question?
I'm just curious, do you know if he moved objects around? Did he do any sort of set design? Or?
I think he did. I think he did. And I actually spent a little time talking about that. And the reason I think this is the first picture of the series. Once again, it's this one. That's a. I spent a lot of time talking about this series. And there's a portrait of Dora Maar by Picasso that kind of looks like this picture. And now you see it, right? That's the joke, which is why I think he did this. In other words, why he moved stuff around, because The lampshade in the middle is the nose. The air conditioner is the one eye. And the and he does this in other pictures, this kind of collage thing.
But how does he know he's going to get it?
That's the thing that
I don't know.
How does he know what the picture on the TV is going to be? That makes it so...
Did he
early what's VCR? Fascinating is that Picasso's retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art happens in 1959, and it at that time is the single largest museum exhibition ever. It becomes the paradigm of the mega art museum show. And it's Picasso, right, at the moment where he is like the guy, right? He's like modern art. When you think about modern art and your grandmother talks about modern art, they talk about Picasso, right? And I think one of the things he's doing in this picture is taking the piss out of Picasso.
This is in a chandelier, though, maybe too.
Sorry?
Buñuel Dalí's chandelier.
Yeah, and that picture is actually in the book, as well as the Dzigovertov picture of the man with a movie camera. So there's a number of references here that are context that I, yeah.
There's something almost voyeuristic about Saul, Anton. Saul. I flipped your name.
Oh.
I wrote like a flickering television screen, but what I was thinking was just that, you know, if these rooms are staged, they're always staged without the television as the hearth or without the television as the center of the commons. The room is not organized around them. So it's as though we're looking at something that actually wasn't meant to be looked at.
That wasn't meant to be looked at.
That is, nobody else is looking at this. The chairs are always orthogonal to it or even looking back at it.
Not always. But yes, generally there's the kind of frontality and flatness which evacuates that space and doesn't allow you to read it in a kind of realistic way. I'm looking at a room with a television in it. The one that's on the cover, this one, is one of the exceptions. But there's some that are like this and then a lot that are simply flattened.
And even there, you don't have a sense that the room is pointed towards the television, any that I remember.
Yeah, and in this one you do. And I think
the chair is, you sit in that chair and you look across the television.
Well, I think the difference between the ones in the 1960s, the ones in the magazine spread, which are the initial series, and then what happens in the book later, because I think what happens in the book is he develops essentially his own sort of account and his reflection on what the television screen is and what it represents for photography. And what it represents is the evacuation of the traditional photographic subject and the need for a kind of construction that Wall wants to be a picture, but to my mind is much less of a picture, that's much more like a flickering screen. I don't think Lee Friedlander ever embraces the sort of high art paradigm that Michael Fried says, that's why photography is art like never before in 2007. In fact, he moves really against that in everything that he does. There's a kind of amateurism, or there's a sort of distractedness, and there's a kind of there's no way to put the picture together in any way that makes sense. You end up moving across the sort of hierarchies of what this should be. So you think, I'm looking at a photograph, and then you go, no, this is about a Picasso painting of Dora Maar, or this is about some weird construction. And it really resists that kind of sort of unification aesthetically. And that's kind of the sort of primary argument of the book and what that means for photography. So, yeah, I think that's really right.
Super. Sorry, thank Sina, you so for much, Saul. Over. Thank you so much for great.
Thank you very much.
We have some wine and beer. Please hang out. Saul can answer more questions on the floor. And if you'd like a copy of the book, it's for sale back here. Thank you.